All right, David Morata is here with us in studio and joins us each and every month, and we have a terrific time ahead today. He's the president of Morata Wealth Management online, where you can read terrific columns at moratahonmoney.com. Today, it's government shutdown versus government restraint. So let's talk about this current process that we have in America for budgeting, because it really seems like the dysfunctionality is right there in the process. It's badly broken, isn't it?
It's true. Thank you so much for having me on the show. We all know the United States has been sinking deeper into debt, and each year Congress just blindly votes to spend even more than last year and raising the debt ceiling ever higher. And it's kind of questionable why we have a debt ceiling. And this budget deficit or this budget turmoil provides us an opportunity really to step back and ask the question, what are the essentials of government that we can all agree on funding? And so the Republican genius has been to suggest, well, if we think this is an essential part of government and we all agree on it, let's pass that. And they've been passing a number of piecemeal budgeting efforts, which the Democrats have been saying, no, it's all or nothing. It's everything we want or nothing. We're gonna fund everything. And that's not really a way toward budget restraint. One way of toward budget restraint is to pass the essentials that everyone can agree on. And the controversial portions of the budget are things that we could do without. And with our growing debt and deficit and our growing government insolvency, it's best to start that process now. And so I agree with the Republicans. I think the genius that they're doing by passing piecemeal budget offerings that will fund portions of the government that are not in dispute is a good way to start the process of trying to rein in a government that has no restraint.
You know, I wanted to talk about this word piecemeal, because I was speaking with my wife, I think it was yesterday, and she said, you know, that's really, maybe we should think of a different term. That's the term of the left, because piecemeal makes it sound like there's something wrong with it. And maybe we should call it prioritized budgeting or sectional or some other word. Do you agree that could be taken in a negative way? And really, I think this is a positive approach.
It is described piecemeal by its liberal opponents. The term I use is one line item at a time, but
yes,
you're right, it's prioritizing it. It's putting the most important things first. It's exactly what every family has to do in order to build real wealth. You have to take your income, and then you have to take your outgo, and you have to put one line item at a time and say, okay, I'm going to pay my rent. I'm going to keep my lights on. I'm going to fund my children. I'm clothing. I'm going to provide for food. And then there are things I won't do. So I won't get that new car that I've been lusting after.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't go to the movies every single night. And I won't eat out every single night, because those are luxuries that we can't afford. And so prioritizing the budget one line item at a time is a way of doing what many have suggested in the line item veto from the president. But why not do it one line item at a time from Congress itself? Why doesn't Congress say, this is most important, and if you don't think it's most important, vote against it. We'll move it down in the priorities, and we'll vote on it again. And that way we can vote one line item at a time, prioritized for the most important portions of government. We can't afford to continue funding things that are both controversial and wasteful.
You know, this is very interesting, because having been an elected official and been through the budget process, those on the left and some of them in the right center really resist this because they love to buy votes. So if you lump everything in together, then you can't find who's getting what money and what the priority is. And so they never want to undergo the prioritization exercise, because it exposes their fraud.
It's true. Entitlements represent an ever-increasing portion of federal spending, and we collect more money to redistribute it than to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And that redistribution buys votes in Congress. If you want less corruption in Congress, you'll give Congress less money to redistribute. So corporate welfare is the norm. Pork barrel spending still runs rampant. And all attempts to starve the beast of government spending really have failed. And so this would be an opportunity for every line item, including the pork barrel spending, to be put up for a vote and a potential veto. And that gives the best check and balance that we have, because you're right, it can't be hidden then. It has to be decided up front.
And the other trick they do is if they lump it all into the budget, into one big budget, and somebody votes against it, then they can use this trick that they do on the left. Well, that conservative voted against education because he voted against the budget, or he voted against the veterans because he voted against the budget. It's an insidious little trick that the left uses. It was used on me, but I see it used all the time when people stand up and vote against a big budget that has everything in it. This gets rid of that, doesn't it?
It's true, it does. And not only that, but you could pass certain portions of the budget for multiple years. So, for example, if the veterans benefits are a really important part of the budget, every year you could pass a budget that funds the Veterans Administration for the next 5 years. And then even if you voted against it 1 year, you'd still have 4 more years before veterans benefits would run out. And if you couldn't reach some impasse. And so that would take things like veterans benefits or other things that are deemed essential or non-controversial off of the table. And then when the budget shutdown did happen, you'd still have 5 years of spending for everything that you thought was so important that you gave it 5 years worth of spending.
David Morata is our guest. 977-1070 is the phone number. We're talking today about the government, a government shutdown, which really is not a shutdown because there's obviously people out there putting cones up in South Dakota and guarding the monuments from our veterans and updating Let's Move website. Anyway, 977-1070 is the phone number. We're talking about the government slowdown versus government restraint. Greg, welcome to the Shilling Show.
Hey, how are you, David? Hey, Rob.
Hi, Greg.
I'd like to just make a couple comments and get David to comment back. And that is, you know, our documents, we are all created equal. That doesn't mean that we are guaranteed equal outcome. We just have equal access where there wouldn't be somebody who would do something to stop you unfairly from trying. But what we have is a president that wants equal outcome, which is pure Marxism. And I would like to see us defund welfare, subsidize housing for all able-minded, able-bodied people. I'd like to eliminate unemployment insurance. You know, I've been self-employed all my life, and, you know, I'd get up on a Monday not knowing whether I have anything to do or not and go through stages of not having anything to do, and it's very fearful. But when the government workers are laid off, they freak out, and I feel bad for them because they got families, but there are no guarantees no matter where you work. And I think we need to eliminate this safety net for able-minded, able-bodied people completely, except for people who may be handicapped or have disabilities or the elderly. It needs to be eliminated, and we need to wash it all out. And I think the Congress should stand strong and defund Obamacare at all costs. And I just want to listen to what you all have to say about that.
Greg, before you go, are you still there?
Yes.
Yeah, into my email box today. Let me just add another one to your list. UVA researchers receive $1.6 million grant to develop pre-K literacy assessment in Spanish. Those are your tax dollars and mine.
That's wrong. That absolutely goes against our grain. We're a melting pot. And when you do things in the name of diversity, you divide. The Germans and the Irish and all the Europeans came here originally, and they learned to be a melting pot and acclimate. That's the way it should be. That's why we were successful. It doesn't mean you can't be proud of your heritage your heritage be respect, but we are a melting pot. Learn English.
Amen, Greg. Let's get a response from David in our minute here before we have to go to the break.
Yeah, Greg is exactly right. For 2 years, Democrats had a majority sufficient to pass socializing health care. They passed it 220 to 215 in the House and exactly the 60 votes they needed in the Senate to overcome a filibuster. Many of those Democrats lost their seats in the next election by constituents who want the legislation undone. They're exactly like Greg. They're mad. They're upset. They're mad and upset for good reason, because it's such a watershed issue that they don't want to compromise now just because the Democrats refused to compromise in 2010 when they passed the legislation. And so the question really is, why should a 2-year majority ratchet us towards socialism in a way that can't be undone? The Republicans are representing their districts of saying there's a number of Americans that want the legislation completely undone. And they want to move on and do something differently.
977-1070. That's the phone number. Comments, questions, or challenges for David Morata. We'll continue on government slowdown versus government restraint when the Shilling Show continues. Stay with us. Here's another targeted instance of inflicting pain. This is a story right now out of Philadelphia. A marathoner said he was fined $100 for running in Valley Forge Historic National Park during the government shutdown, parked his car in a remote parking lot, not blocked by a barrier, and said two rangers were waiting with their car lights flashing when he returned and gave him a ticket for $100. You know, I thought the parks belonged to us. I thought we didn't have enough money, but I guess they can have two cruisers sitting there with their lights flashing, waiting to give a guy who was jogging a ticket. Our priorities seem really out of whack, David.
They do. It's difficult to watch when government is trying to shut down everything that they can possibly shut down to make the effects worse than they need to be.
Mm-hmm.
Taking down the websites is a great example of that. Shutting down the parks is a great example of that. And basically, it's trying to hold people hostage to whatever government goodies that they normally rely upon for the normal functioning of government. And I think Milton Friedman was the one who wrote an article called "The Fragility of Freedom at 60%," in which he said, more and more people are beholden to government for something that they want, corporate welfare, tax credits, government grants. And it isn't really limited to the truly needy who rely upon it for their safety net. It's everyone, including rich people who have tax breaks and mm-hmm. and things that they're trying to make sure they do. And what we need is some patriots who are willing to overlook potential good that they can get out of the government and still vote for government restraint. That's the problem in Greece. Everyone in America looks at Greece and says, wow, that's really bad. We'd never let it get that far. And yet they're the same people who are saying the government ought to just pass a budget no matter what it takes. And they ought to just sit down and get the job done and compromise. And if you think that the job of government is to pass the budget at all costs, then the Democrats can hold at all costs up and gouge out anything that they want out of the Republicans. So if one group is willing to have government restraint and risk a government shutdown, I think that it makes them heroes and patriots willing to jeopardize some of the functions of government to make sure that we get just an essential government and we get a leaner and more responsible government.
977-1070 is the phone number. Comments or questions, challenges for David Murata. The line's open right now at 977-1070 here on The Shilling Show. You know, it is interesting when you talk about people voting against their own interest in the short term. You know, I'd love to see a lot of these tax deductions and maybe even some of them that I take advantage of just go away. Give me a flat tax. Let me just pay what I owe. And that's fine. And in some ways, it might hurt me tax wise. But in other ways, I think it would be good for me in the long run. I'd pay a lot less money to have my taxes done. Everything would be simple. I could understand what was going on. And all of these shenanigans would be gone. And yet there are people who masquerade as conservatives. I'm thinking of one guy here who, when I was running for city council, kind of gave me a lot of money and masqueraded as a conservative. It turned out he was a crony socialist because once I got elected, he came to me and he said, you want to make sure that Paramount Theater gets some money over there because they really need it. And I'm thinking, gosh, I thought you were a fiscal conservative. And yet this was a crony socialist who was really looking out for everybody else's budget, but when it came to his pet project, he wanted money thrown over to a crony socialist project.
It's true. Rent-seeking, the idea that you can get more money not by producing some good, but by manipulating the government system to get money. Rent-seeking is as widespread as corporate cronyism, and it's difficult to curb that without government restraint, and sometimes you need a few patriots who are willing to jeopardize the entire system of Greece that makes the political wheels spin in order to say, no, we're not going to vote for that. And if our representatives refuse to vote for non-essential funding, they would vote no on almost every spending bill. And so that's why the one line item at a time that makes it clean and pure and allows true patriots to be able to vote for the essential portions of government is, I think, the right way to do it.
I agree with you 100%, and I really look at this as an opportunity to prioritize, and yet there are a lot of people who say the sky is going to fall. I think there was a warning that came out from the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, today about this this looming disaster of American default. So let's talk about, you know, what happens if we hit the debt ceiling.
Yeah, if we hit the debt ceiling, then the federal government will have to start a pay-as-you-go system. We will not be able to increase the debt. which means only as revenues come in will they be able to pay something and move the revenue out. Currently, the servicing the debt, the interest on the debt, is actually a very small portion of the government. So long as they take the first, I think it's somewhere around 6 to 10%, the first 6 to 10%, and they pay off the interest, we will not default on our bonds. So then beyond that, they have to take the remaining 90-some-odd percent and start prioritizing what they're going to spend and what they're not going to spend. And they might need to take some of those park rangers and not pay them to go give tickets to people, mm-hmm. or they might need to not have some of the corporate welfare that they have, or they may need to not fund the National Endowment for the Arts or the National Education or something like that. Some of these things that actually don't educate and don't produce art, but they nevertheless receive government funding. And so pay-as-you-go is a great system. In the financial world, whenever we're trying to help someone who's deep into debt, the first thing you do is you cut up their credit cards, and that does the exact same thing. You cannot borrow more money. You still have to pay the interest on the credit card balance that you have run up, but you can't borrow more money. And I found, because there's a mindset of we can just borrow money and spend it, personally, within a household budget, the same thing is true within Congress. And if you don't cut up the credit cards, you actually won't get any kind of restraint. And so that's what hitting the debt ceiling would do, is it would immediately impose massive restraint and be the equivalent of cutting up our government credit cards.
I say bring it on. It's time. Now, you referenced that, you know, the debt service is a relatively small amount, and yet that could grow dramatically if we experience an increase in interest rates, and particularly if we get hyperinflation, which people have been talking about for years now, that it is ultimately inevitable.
It is. That's usually the way a country gets into financial trouble, is they borrow and borrow and borrow when interest rates are relatively low, and then all it takes is for interest rates to rise 1 or 2%, and suddenly a much higher portion of the country's budget is going toward servicing the debt, until finally that overwhelms the country and all the tax revenue in the world can't seem to service the debt fast enough and still provide any kind of lights on in the administration. So if we're worried about the lights being off now, just imagine that the corporate credit or the government credit cards were all cut up and we couldn't borrow anything more. And that's the shock to the system. And right now the shock is relatively low because our budget is not as high as it will be and the interest is not as high as it will be. But later on, when they won't loan us money and our debt is high, it would be much harder to pay off.
Let's go to the phones, and there is a line open for you at 977-1070. We welcome your calls, comments, and questions for David Murata. Challenges, all welcome. Ellie stands by at 977-1070. And John is with us on The Shilling Show. John, welcome, and give us your question for David.
Hi, Rob. Hi, David. I was wondering how the shutdown will affect the Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists in the Syria that Obama has been illegally arming and providing training to battle Assad. I wonder if they're going to be also cut off, or if that's a separate budget that he can continue funding.
Yeah, fascinating question.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that won't affect it at all, because, one, it's not visible to the public, so it's not something that you would want to shut down necessarily. And second, most of the portions of our military are considered essential, and so any international relations like that is usually considered essential. Non-essential portions of the government are actually very small, and they're usually paid retroactively anyway. So even though the government is shut down and some people are not getting paid, there has not yet been a shutdown in which all of those people didn't receive retroactive pay. I wouldn't say that that's a given. It's not necessarily a given. It's just true that in every other shutdown, the politicians are quick to keep those constituencies happy and to make sure that they get retroactive pay. The difficulty with government workers is, as I said, more and more of us are becoming dependent upon that government funding, and it's a difficult way to live then, because we're not in control of our own ability to earn for ourselves, and we are beholden, if you will, to the government. And while I think a government safety net is important for the least fortunate in society, increasingly it's been not a safety net, it's been a bribe for people who don't need it. And the safety net has either become a hammock or it's become a trap. And the trap at the bottom is difficult because there's so many government goodies at the bottom that in many cases, welfare pays better than minimum wage. And so it's very difficult then to get off of welfare and onto minimum wage, because you have to go from not working at all to working full time at a minimum wage job just to try to develop the skills necessary to be paid a higher wage later.
And that's not to mention the debilitating personal effect of being paid to sit around and do nothing, which is bad for the soul, bad for the spirit, and makes people angry and resentful.
Yep. A safety net to get back on your feet is great. A hammock or a trap is unfortunately more of what government spending does.
Let's go back to the phones, 977-1070. The phone number, David Morata, our guest here on The Shilling Show. Hi, Richard. Richard, are you there? Okay, I think we lost Richard, so let's see if he can call us back. 977-1070 is the phone number. So the thing that I want to get into here is paying off $17 trillion. It seems totally insurmountable. I mean, I know that you start by just nibbling away at it, but is it possible to pay off $17 trillion? And that may just be the tip of the iceberg.
Well, the plan within the government is to pay off $17 trillion not by actually funding a budget surplus of $17 trillion, but by simply trying to hold the $17 trillion down while inflation eats away 5% of it each year. Mm. And so $17 trillion today may sound like a lot, but in 10 or 20 years with a 5% inflation, even 10 years with a 5% inflation will have eaten half of it, so long as we cannot continue to add to it. The problem is we're actually adding to the deficit faster than inflation is eating away at it. And that's where we have to hold it constant more. So devaluing the dollar is the choice method of governments to be able to whittle away at their deficits. And devaluing the dollar unfortunately hurts poor people the worst, because poor people tend to have their savings in dollars. They don't tend to have it in equity investments, stock investments that can appreciate by inflation and then some. And so while the wealthy can protect their wealth by investments, the poor generally don't protect their wealth and find it very difficult to build wealth with a 5% inflation headwind eating away at their savings as fast as they possibly can.
But David, this policy has been promoted mainly by people who consider themselves or call themselves guardians of the poor. I mean, they're hurting the poor, but they're saying, hey, let us give you all these programs, but all the deficit spending is hurting probably more than the programs are helping.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've studied cognitively the difference between liberals and conservatives. You talked about the book The Liberal Mind, which I haven't read. I have read The Blank Slate by Steven Pinker, and his chapter on politics is fascinating. The liberal mindset is that motives are pretty much all that matters. So long as you have pure motives, as long as you have altruistic motives, if you're misguided, well, that's just a lack of knowledge, but we can overcome that with more knowledge and centralized planning, and we just need to refine it a little bit. So for liberals, so long as they have good intentions of trying to help the poor, the fact that those good intentions are actually making it more difficult for the poor, or the fact that those good intentions are creating either a hammock or a trap for the poor, are irrelevant, because they're good people because they have good intentions. So when conservatives say, I'm sure you have good intentions, but your policies don't work, they actually cause harm objectively, regardless of your good intentions, liberals actually hear that and they think, well, you've already conceded I have good intentions, so you've just lost the argument. You know that I'm trying to do good, and that's all that really matters. Whereas for liberals, they can't imagine that a libertarian or a conservative who wants to fundamentally change our welfare system, they can't imagine that we're doing that for good reasons and that we have good intentions. They cannot concede that, because if they concede that, they think that they've lost the entire battle. And that's why most often liberals are portraying conservatives as heartless beasts who just want to see babies starving and people downtrodden with boots upon their heads. That's the typical way that liberals will do that. And it's because motives are everything to them.
977-1070 is the phone number. Just a few minutes left with David Morata here on The Shilling Show. you know, you wrote some interesting things about what might happen if we hit the debt ceiling. And you were looking at this, I think it was a couple years ago. But one of them was a stronger dollar, which actually defeats this dilution of the dollar.
It does. If we actually had to start paying our own way and we didn't have easy money, we weren't floating a lot of bonds, we weren't increasing the deficit that way, the dollar would become very strong. And a strong dollar has implications. So if the dollar becomes strong, then that means the dollar is very valuable and it takes less dollars to buy things. So the price of everything falls, especially the price of the stock market, which is very, very in sync with that. So the stock market goes down anytime it looks like we're actually going to get serious about trying to have governmental restraint. We're not going to have an easy money system. We're going to have any kind of tapering of quantitative easing. That's when the dollar gets strong. And so you see things like hard assets go up in value, but you also see things like the stock market go down in terms of dollars, even if they're going up in terms of buying power. And so it's important for investors to realize that the stock market is still the right place to be because it hedges you in terms of buying power, even if it doesn't hedge you in terms of dollar. If the dollar becomes weak, the value of the stock market will go up a lot, but it will also be taxable going up because you'll have to pay capital gains tax on it. If the dollar becomes strong, the stock market will go down, but it will have the same buying power, and it will still continue to go up by about 6.5% over inflation. So the stock market provides a store of value that's much better than dollars because they're hedged against the dollar going down in value.
How about interest rates? What happens to interest rates once we draw the line?
Yeah, because the government has this easy money policy, it's fairly easy to borrow money right now, and interest rates are at a relative low. So interest rates will go up as well, and that will force more restraint on terms of borrowing on the entire country. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it will have that effect. And so right now, the best hedge you have against inflation is certainly a 30-year fixed mortgage for as much as you can get it for. And so if you lock in a 30-year fixed mortgage at the current interest rates, then you will, I think, in 10 years, be very glad that you did. My first interest rate, I assumed the loan of the buyer before me for 12.5%.
Mm-hmm.
I was so glad because interest rates were at 18%. And so I think we may see the days of the late 70s, early 80s again as interest rates go up in value as money becomes tighter.
Yeah, I remember having one somewhere around 11.5, 11.75, and I had a chance to lock it down when it fell, and I locked it at 10.625, and I was overjoyed.
At any rate, my hope is that this budget crisis will allow us to pass the budget one line item at a time, and we can see it even for multiple years, that we can see the things that we agree on. Because I actually think there are more things that we agree on in this country than we disagree. It's just all the things that we disagree about, the Democrats want the Republicans to cave on.
So if we look ahead here, what do you think is going to happen over the next week? Because or the next weeks ahead, it appears to me that if the Republicans cave this time, that's pretty much it.
Well, everyone is blaming John Bonier for all of the budget troubles. I wrote him a thank you note and said, keep up the good work. If you're the reason why we're not caving on everything, then you have my support in that. And I think for a number of Republicans, they've all there's at least a large amount of the Republican Party who thinks that this is the battle to die on. This is the hill to fight on. And if Obamacare goes in, we'll have socialized health care, and that's probably one of the worst things that could happen. If that will be enough Republicans to be able to hold the line on that, I don't know. My best guess is that there will be a compromise in which the national news will think that we have gotten most of what the Democrats want, but there'll be a few concessions for the Republicans so that they can save face and still cave. That's my worry, and I think that that's probably what will happen. But the longer that they're willing to hold out, I think the better the prospects for getting a grand deal that includes a lot more than just a few token items.
It reminds me, and you and I probably are of the same vintage, and we remember the commercial from Fram Oil Filters where the guy stops and he looks at him and he says, "You can pay me now or you can pay me later." The implication is you pay me now to put in an oil filter, it's going to be relatively cheap compared to paying me later by putting in a new engine.
Yeah, and that's the point at which this is the point to hold the line. Democrats have to remember that not a single Republican voted for Obamacare and the move towards socialized medicine. The legislation is a mess, and it's a mess because the entire structure of it is wrong. Healthcare insurance should not pay for the first dollar spent. The purpose of insurance is to cover yourself against catastrophic loss. And to us, this is the equivalent of having grocery store insurance. We think it's that bad and that fundamentally flawed. And with grocery store insurance, you have no one caring about how much things cost, but you also have no filet mignon because it's all been scavenged up by people and there's a shortage. And so price-fixing grocery store insurance doesn't work, and it's that important an issue to Republicans, and that's why they're standing against a budget that's including anything about Obamacare.
He's online at MuradaOnMoney.com. As always, a very terrific hour. Thanks so much, David Murata.
Thank you.